Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I am very pleased to welcome back to the programme the one and only Andy Jennings of Dissident Prophet fame, whom I hold in hugely high esteem, as I know a lot of listeners do, for the fantastic band and the fantastic conversations that we've had in the past with Andy and the crew. And it's some time since we've actually spoken to him, but we welcome him back to the show to talk about, well, quite a lot of things really, perhaps an infinite number of things connected with what's been happening over the last 2 to 3 years. And I'm conceiving of this as being part of the informal series that I've got going on here at TMR called The New Old Normal, Following Christ in the New Old Normal. Shall I rehearse what that means for people who've not heard that before? It's basically, we were sold the idea of a new normal, and we were all saying, oh dear, if only we could get back to the old normal. But no, we need a kind of new old normal where we learn from the experiences of the last few years. So Andy, it's great to be speaking to you. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Oh, pleasure, man. Thank you.
It's wonderful to be speaking to you again after, well, I was going to say, you know, it seems like years, but actually we did have a conversation, didn't we, a few months back where we suggested perhaps having this formal conversation. I was going to say it's not formal, is it? It's actually a very informal, unstructured conversation. And I said to you, okay, let's have a conversation like this. You sent me some ideas here and I've got them in front of me. And I'm basically going to be asking you some of the things that you suggested you might want to talk about. Mm. So I'll start with a really inane question, okay? How's life been since, the end of 2019?
Extra bubbly. Fantastic. Total freedom I've been experiencing. No, man, it's crazy, isn't it, really? Because we didn't speak for a while, you know, as lots of people didn't.
Absolutely.
And, yes, what's gone on? What's happened in the world? It's flipping nuts, isn't it? You know.
Yeah. You know. Yep. That's why you're on the show. Make sense of it for us today, Andy. Only you can do it.
It's a lot on my shoulders, mate. How am I going to do this? Okay. All right.
So where do we start? So where do we start with this? I mean, you sent me notes about, let's talk about how could it happen that so many people in society went along with the whole narrative that we were fed. Mm. Over those 2 years or so. So many people didn't question what was going on. Anybody who did, of course, was silenced, was marginalized. And then, of course, we saw in the church, the institutions of the church is very often a similar sort of process taking place, which was quite disturbing. And again, not talking about everybody and not talking about all of the church and et cetera, et cetera. Mm. But some sort of parallel was going on there, which disturbed a lot of people, a lot of listeners as well. And we've been trying to make sense of that ever since, really. You also mentioned about the new people who you met by attending marches and things. And of course, in my experience, going to a stand in the park and meeting new people who had similar concerns. In my case, many of whom were not believers. There's some similarity there of experience, although I only went to one march. I think you went to several. I don't know. Where do you want to start with any of that?
Okay. So we had the initial lockdown, didn't we, before the vaccines came out?
Yeah.
And it was, how do I explain it? Well, I'll just put a little bit of a background. I was going through some personal issues, family issues and stuff like that. And I was kind of like a bit vulnerable. I'd moved out of the house. And then I was told, come the time of the vaccine thing, by my employers, that because it was partly funded by the NHS, that I could get the vaccine. And to be honest with you, I was kind of out of the loop so far as red pilling kind of stuff is, you know, which is what you get on you talk about, and I've always talked about. I was not in a good state, but I was suddenly at the pressure from my boss and my job that they were saying, hey, great news, you can get this vaccine. And I said, well, I don't know anything about it. I genuinely knew nothing about it. I wasn't even thinking about it. I wasn't red pilling. I should have been. I normally would have been. But I wasn't even in the circles that I'm normally in with my friends who were all kind of red pilling about things and talking about stuff. And I was kind of in another headspace. Yeah. And I was told I could have it. And I said, well, I don't really want it. I'd rather wait 6 months or 2 years or something and see what it does to people because it hasn't been tested. And they went, oh, that's fine. You just won't have a job.
Wow.
It's like, you know, you just won't get paid. And I was going, what?
Gosh, having first of all sold it to you by saying, hey, this is great news. You can have this wonderful way out of the pandemic. And then to be told, oh, well, you lose your job if you don't have it.
With a smile, with a nice smile on the face, like, you know, no, you're free to not have it.
Yeah.
you just won't be paid. It's like, right. Oh, lovely freedom, you know. Not really.
Well, now that's very interesting, because that is something of a model for the future, isn't it? You know, on so many levels. Oh, it's your choice. Yeah. We're going to give you the freedom to use this digital currency or whatever. We're going to give you the freedom to use this digital ID. But you don't have to. You can stick to the old way of doing things.
Yeah.
But of course, your life will be made hell gradually and more if you don't.
Yeah. But here's the disappointing thing. I buckled, right? Mm. I was weak. I now see that. I was disappointed in myself. I have nothing but disdain for Andy Jennings, right? Because I freaked and I thought, well, I'd better go get it. And I went and got this first thing. I was living in this house with a bunch of people and they'd all got it and their legs were all spasming and they were having like seizures down the sides of their heads and stuff.
What's that? You laugh, but dear, dear. Which one did you get, by the way? Do you know which one?
It was a Pfizer, but I think I might have dodged a bullet. I might have ended up getting the number one, the saline solution, which is a placebo, because I didn't have any side effects. So I don't know. I don't know. I tried to do everything I possibly could. Anyway, I remember contacting Tom. I hadn't spoke to Tom for a while, and Tom went, oh, Andy, what have you done? And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, do you know about the vaccine? And I was like, well, I don't know really. He went, you need to read about it. So I did some research, and it was like, oh, got buyer's remorse straight away. My friend Adrian, you know Adrian, he lives in Australia. I was chatting with him. He went, Andy, what you done? It's like, can't believe you did that. You know, and I was like, so yes, very, very instantly, very sad. And a lot of my friends and Red Bull friends were like, Andy, come on, what are you doing? You know, so I freaked. But I suddenly thought, well, I prayed about it. I also took some Suramin, which is like a pine needle. Which I know attacks the spike protein. Mm. You know, and I was also on the keto diet at the same time. So I actually think I might have inadvertently helped myself, because that's a very anti-inflammatory diet. And we're talking about inflammation, really, with what's going on with the spike protein and all that kind of stuff. So I think I dodged a bullet. We'll see. I've still got, you know, the future to go. We don't know what the effect will be. But anyway, I said, right, that's it. Not again. Mm. And then I went quiet. This is just in the context of my employment. And then 9 months later, they found out that I hadn't had the others. And that's when I got in trouble. And then the government voted, I think it was 300 people in Parliament, majority, no, Labour, it was uniparty kind of voting. They just said that anyone who's partly funded or was put in a frontline in NHS has got to have it by April of 2020, what was it? Is it 2022, 2021? Can't remember now.
Yes, I'm losing track of it as well. Yes, indeed.
Anyway, and that's when I was called in to my work, and they said, oh, it's disgraceful. You know, they called me all sorts of things under the sun.
Wow.
You know, I was a threat to humanity, threat to people. I was immature, I was selfish. It was all sorts of things. And it wasn't just in that kind of language, you know. And I just kicked back and said, get lost, you know. No way, mate. This is serious. You know, I take it personally. If I get jabbed, something put in my body, it isn't a game anymore. I take it very personally, offensively, that, you know, this is what I've been coerced into doing. It's meant to be a choice. It's your body, your choice. And this was not. It was a very pivotal moment for me. It was like, okay, you've got to be prepared to lose everything for truth or for something that matters, that really matters. And something about your body and what you do with your body, that is really spiritually true as well. Like, it's profound, really.
Absolutely.
It's the kind of autonomy that God has given us to make informed choices, risky ones or not so risky, and risk either way. Mm. And this idea that suddenly a company, an organization, a government, or somebody was telling you what to do with your body. It was profound. Mm. It's profound.
It was, absolutely. It was certainly crossing a line, wasn't it? Because I had that sense very definitely that, you know, once this line is crossed, well, in principle, you could be told to do anything, put anything in your body. Mm. This is good for you. This is good for society. You must take it. And there was nothing really about this so-called pandemic that I think justified that kind of reaction. It wasn't as if half the population was dropping dead in front of us, was it? You know?
No.
Not only that, it's not as if the companies involved or the governments pushing these were of such high moral standing in every way that one could just say, yes, I trust you implicitly with what you're doing here. None of this really fitted together.
No.
And it was very frightening with you on the same page there.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because I remember reading, I don't know if you've heard of Derek Gilbert, but I remember reading Sharon Gilbert's books about, and she based these fiction books based on exactly this scenario.
Right.
You know, gosh. Amazing. Mm. And so obviously did a lot of digging, did a lot of searching, and you know, and then it's just been so encouraging to see so many other people digging and searching from all sorts of, I've met people that I never would have met normally. And that's when we weren't meant to be meeting anyone.
Right.
Oh, dear. With all that.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about with that. Just going back to what you said.
Yes, sir.
No, what you said about watching those MPs go through to vote aye or nay. I mean, it was just astonishing. I actually watched it in real time. I know a lot of people did because it was, you know, such a pivotal moment, to use that phrase, of a very good movie that I hope people have seen, this pivotal moment. But yeah, there's a sense of incredulity when I was watching the screen. Are these MPs actually going to vote to coerce, actually mandate NHS workers in this way? And I thought, surely it won't actually go. It was astonishing. I wonder whether they really realised what they were doing. They were just gripped by fear to such an extent that they did it anyway. So many times it seemed to be fear that was ruling the day throughout the whole period.
I think there's different types of fear. One would be the fear of the thing, which isn't very scary, it turns out. And also the fear of just stepping out and being accused of being a killer of humanity if you didn't go along with it, because it was painted in such a way. The fact that government actually hired people to use psychological methods to scare us even more, make it seem all... It's actually official. They did that.
Oh, yeah.
Our taxpayers' money went on propaganda against us, you know, to scare the flicking daylights out of us, you know. That is something I never thought... You know what? Boris Johnson, I'll be honest with you. I read a few of his books... He's like a good historian, I thought, and he's this bumbling Boris, you know, he's on Have I Got News For You, and he apologises for saying doing silly things, and he's like, at least he's a bit more transparent than everyone else. Man, what happened to him? I don't think it's Boris. I think the real one's in Area 51, level 13. I think he got swapped.
I know what you mean. Because, like, yeah, there were a number of times when I saw him in the House of Commons and something was being said and he was just sat there and I just looked at him and the look on his face was of total dejection, as if he was thinking, there's nothing I can do. I'm not really, not only not in control here, I'm not even contributing to what's going on here. I had that sense that you know, it was out of his hands, really.
Yeah.
I'm not letting him off the hook.
No, no.
Just that
he's
sense
responsible. He's responsible.
It was all too big. It was happening around him.
It felt like he'd got the memo.
Yeah.
And he was just going,
felt like it.
Oh, you know, like looking at, sorry, you can blurt that out. But yeah, and he's just looking at his feet like a naughty schoolboy and going, oh, okay. I don't know. He was just owned from that point onwards. And you could just tell. And it just shows the power, you know, the raw power. The juggernaut behind this, Big Pharma and a big multinational, the World Health Organization, the WEF, World Economic Forum. And they've been around a long time, and it's like it's their hour. It's like, finally, we've got our hour kind of thing. And the chatterati of Britain and any other countries, European countries, all talk about this meaninglessly left-right kind of paradigm. It's nothing to do with that. Our politicians are just bought and paid for, you know.
Yeah, it's Democracy Incorporated. There was a book, wasn't there, by Sheldon Wolin, well, quite a number of years ago, about 15 years ago or so, talking about this inverted totalitarianism.
Yeah.
So actually it's the corporate world more and more owning governments in various ways. And I think we saw that come to fruition.
Yeah.
You know, Brett Weinstein talks about what we've been through actually diagnosing the system. You know, we should learn from actually what happened. It's not like it's over. It's like, no, that revealed something of the framework, the system in which we live.
I mean, there's so many...
We must learn and not forget those lessons as we go forward, because it's the same system. It's still there.
There's so many levels on which you can look at this.
Yeah.
It's multidimensional. And we can talk about this, the personal effect. We can talk about the big business. We can talk about the New World Order. We can talk about all those kind of things. But I think it's more profound spiritually.
Absolutely.
Because those are all like the details that follow the spiritual thing, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So we could have a good conversation about what we already know, and we could get black, you know, red-pilled and black-pilled about it and everything. Everyone's talking about that. Even Russell Brand is on that page now.
Yeah.
So let's not talk about all that. Let's talk about the spiritual significance of this. What's underlying? What does God represent? What is God like, and what is his adversary like? What are those two paradigms? The adversary is about control and fear, deception and manipulation, and taking away your autonomy as a creature made in the image of God. God is about wanting you to grow into the person that's autonomous but in relationship with him, and to be like him. And God is free. He wants us to be free but in relationship with him. And that's been the most profound thing to me. I mean, we're talking about our problem now, but it would have been the same thing if you lived in communist China or Russia. It would have been the same thing if you'd come under the Nazis. You'd be saying the same things. The contrast between those two kingdoms, Jesus' kingdom and the other kingdom. To me, it's become very the whole experience and the whole looking at it has become really profound to me. And it kind of coincides with my kind of theology changing over the last, say, 10 years. Not changing, but just deepening.
Okay.
I'd say I've gone more down the road of looking at what God's really like, what his kingdom is really like, what the unseen realm is really like. You know, it's with the help of academics like Michael Heiser, really, really helpful, Tim Mackey,
oh, yes.
N.T. Wright, people like these guys, really understanding what the gospel really is, not just the simple kind of mainly Platonic form of Christianity, which is like we die, go to heaven because Jesus saved us, but actually what it's more than that, that the kingdom of God being that we should actually actualize that, realize we have autonomy, we have agency as people made by God, and that's been recovered for us by what Jesus did to us. I was thinking about when you go back and read the Gospels, Jesus treats people with respect. Their humanity comes back. He doesn't spoon feed anyone like Christianity does. He actually says, "What do you think? Go figure. Here's a parable. Work it out." He even asks people who need healing. He doesn't heal them. He says, "What do you want?" And they went, "Oh, I want to be healed, please." You know what I mean? He involves you. Mm. That's what I'm thinking. It's what I love about the kingdom of God.
All right, so this change in theology, not fundamental change, as you say, to be absolutely clear about that.
No. Just a deepening.
But you've grown in your theology.
Yeah, widening.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we all do that in various different ways as we go forward. Hopefully we do anyway. It's a good thing to do. So this was already happening to you before the COVID era, was it?
Yeah. I'd say over a period of years.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say slowly, bit by bit, getting more of an excitement about the gospel.
Okay, so if that's the case, then presumably if your eyes were taken more off the kind of futurist view of the end times, etc., but more towards, you mentioned N.T. Wright, so more towards the contributing towards the building of the kingdom here and now, not in a social gospel kind of way, but
in the
sense that what we do here is both relevant now, will have implications in future as that kingdom comes to fruition when Christ returns. So presumably, if you were thinking along those lines, then what actually happened with the churches over the last few years must have struck you probably even more than it did people like me. Because the churches were, again, I'm generalizing, but so many of the churches in my experience seem to have very little sense of cooperating with what God was doing in the here and now. Or, well, I suppose maybe they thought, I don't know, this is a really deep question. Let me just open up about what I think about this. I mean, I have tried to analyze this in the past in terms of perhaps the church thinking about, Romans 13, and we should go along with what the government says, etc. But I've had thoughts about that since, I think actually the majority of people, certainly in my experience, don't even think of things like that. I'm not sure that many of them hold scripture in that high a regard that they might even think to look into the scriptures to find out what it says about that. But I just wonder whether it's more a case of, I've said this before, a kind of civil religion response. The idea that the nation could do anything but, fundamentally the nation, not politics, not left and right, not the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, because we were told, weren't we, we're now putting aside all our differences, we're all in this together, we're working together, it's as if somehow the nation came to the fore and we're all going to struggle through this in a wartime kind of way. And I have that sense that many in the church thought, right, we identify with the nation, we identify with, the church and with God, and with the green fields and the trees and the wonderful things we were taught at school and England, the green and pleasant land, etc. All sort of like a package there.
Yeah.
Rather than saying, what does Romans 13 tell us to do? But rather a sense of, yes, we go along with this because now all the facade has been pushed aside and we're going to get through this. But that was wrong, just to go along like that, not question. Because as a civil religion response, that is bordering on idolatry, I think.
Yeah, well, that's the problem of having a civil religion, you see. That's the trouble of being married to the state in some kind of way. That's part of the deal. It's okay while everything's hunky-dory until the crisis comes, and then you have to, your legs split, you have to go one way or the other. It's a religion.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a secular form of Puritanism. It's a new Puritanism, wasn't it? It's like the Green Movement is Puritania, but also the COVID was Puritania.
Yeah.
You had instant virtue. You were instantly virtuous if you had a vaccine and you wore a mask. Anyone could see you were virtuous, and you could even wear it on your sleeve. I am good because I have done this, and you are not because you have not done that. In a time when there's no faith, no one believes in anything, I think Douglas Murray made a really good point. He says we're so life's kind of so good in a way, or has been, you know, like comfort-wise and everything, we've actually forgotten why we're here. So we've forgotten God. We've forgotten the meaning. We've forgotten truth, goodness, and beauty.
Yeah.
It's some kind of bland form of existence. And COVID, in a sense, actually just upended that. It was like the sea came away from the shore and the pebbles were revealed for what they truly were, what was actually reality. And that before COVID, we were in a state already. It just exposed that we had no faith in anything except the market, you know, or whatever it is.
Yeah, diagnose the system, exactly.
And so we had to have another religion.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we had, it was a beautiful religion. And that's why people loved it. And they didn't want to go back to work because they'd got this religion. And they didn't want to come out of that. And you didn't even have to enforce it. People would just enforce it themselves around the dinner table or around the house or just in their behavior. Then there'd be people going out and, you know, reporting their neighbours to the police for having an extra car on their drive. You know, it was just this religion.
It was extraordinary.
It was like, you know, crazy.
It was. It was not a rational religion. You know?
Yeah.
There was so much a lack of thought about things that we were being told. It was just a case of obey, you were good. Disobey, you were bad. Even more than that, think about it. Try to discern whether what you're being told is real, is not, is true, is false.
Yeah.
Even that put you in the bad category, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, virtue signaling game is very dangerous because, you know, how much is enough? You know, and that's the same thing with a lot with all the other stuff that's come from top down onto us, you know, which we all know about the culture of Marxism and stuff. And
yeah,
straight onto the green thing, isn't it? As well, as soon as this, we're straight into climate change again, even though that's been flogged to death, you know. But it's like, right, okay, now you've got instant virtue because you virtue signal your carbon. Your attitude towards saving the planet.
Yes.
It's terrible.
Yeah. Well, what I noticed particularly was...
It's all right.
Sorry. Continuing with that thought, do you remember how we were encouraged to put up these NHS rainbows in our windows? And everywhere you went, you know, some child had drawn this lovely little rainbow.
Yeah.
And then as soon as it was over, in inverted commas, then it was the Ukraine flag in exactly the same place. And
wow,
I often thought to myself, well, how many of these people who've done that have really thought about that exchange of one picture to the other?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm a bit dubious, you know. It's one virtue signalling to another virtue signalling.
It was a new girlfriend. Old girlfriend gone, COVID, new girlfriend, Ukraine. It's just that. It flipped within one day. I remember when I was a kid, it was like, it was ABBA. And then it was one day, it was Sex Pistols. The next day, it just flipped. Everybody was in, you know. So, you know, it was like that. And it's the psychology. Oh, man. I mean, the thing is, Derren Brown showed us how he did it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. He showed us what can be done, and it was done to us. Man.
He's a behavioural psychologist, isn't he? So,
yeah, but man, mass formation psychosis, honestly.
Yes.
Really, really scary.
Yes. That's an interesting one, isn't it? And most people will know about that, so that's Matthias Desmet's theory, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
He avoids the term psychosis, I believe, so it's mass formation.
Formation,
I think that's... I mean, I'm not a professional about this, of course, but it seems to have explanatory value. I know that C.J. Hopkins, the writer and the playwright, is not so convinced by this, but I don't know whether he interprets it correctly because he talks in terms of this being, you know, trying to blame us for the way that we responded, as if we sort of created this ourselves. But I'm not sure he's quite got that right because my view of Desmet's theory is that it wasn't like this just happened out of the blue. I think people deliberately, you know, certain people in positions of power, we've been talking about behavioral psychologists, you know, actually manipulated this, actually knew something of this psychological response and used it. And so if we then respond in that way, it's not all our fault, is it? So, yeah, I think there's something to be said for that theory.
I think the soil for which this was a perfect ground for all this to happen to us was the fact that the 24/7 cycle of news and information, a bit like 1984, continually going, and the fact that no one has time to actually research or read or digest anything now. So we're all on a wheel, and therefore we're just so susceptible to fear, like look over here or misdirection, because we're already in a state of turmoil. I mean, modern life with everything, with all its interruptions, is a far cry. It's not even good for our gut health wise and everything, you know, our constitution, you know.
Do you sense a heightened level of fear since the COVID era?
Yeah,
well, obviously it's dropped, but I do feel like we're at a higher level than we were beforehand.
Yes.
As if it's somehow being sustained by one crisis after another.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, we're on the drug. And plus, we also, I think there's a psychological aspect to it where we get addicted to bad news as well. You know, Anyone can do that. There's a certain hit you get, dopamine-wise, from bad news. I mean, I got relatives. You know what? I never listened to the BBC. I will never listen to that. I'll tell you a story. I was actually in, when I moved out into this house for 6 months that was around the corner, the guy who produces the global news lived there, right? I can't give you his name because that wouldn't be fair. His room's full of all the mics and the films, and they covered them, the US election in there with green screens and all that stuff. The building, the building, right? You know, like houses have like names over them, right? It was called Whitehall, right?
Okay.
So I could actually say reporting from Whitehall.
Lovely. Quite truthfully, yes.
But
brilliant.
Yeah, you could. Anyway,
I'm with you on that.
He's a great guy.
I can't look at the BBC news for more than a few minutes without shouting at the screen. So, yeah.
I genuinely know that they produce in the news with the boxer shorts on, you know, and there's a bottle of whiskey underneath the chair, you know, really. You know. But it was so interesting because I got to put my fingers on the bars of the fire. And I've always had suspicions that the BBC and the mainstream media is a load of rubbish. It's just a few people fiddling around, a very small world bubble of people. It just looks good as it comes flying out with all the kind of vamps and the music and everything.
Oh, yes. It's very pompous.
But actually, it's nothing. Yeah. It has that kind of sense of real importance and seriousness about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
What I learned from that, it was one of those, you know, man behind the curtain, Toto just pulled the curtain back, you know. And the guy I knew, I said to him, I says, man, you know, should I really believe this kind of stuff? Because he was saying, I said, have you heard of James O'Keefe from the Project Veritas? He says, yeah, I know him. I speak to him once a week. I was like, what? And then I said, have you heard of the Hunter Biden laptop? And he went, yeah, BBC's had it for a year.
Right.
I'm like, well, how come we haven't heard about that? That's a scoop, isn't it, a story?
Right.
And I learned that they just have all the information and they just choose and drip out exactly what they want us to hear.
Yeah.
You know.
All the news that's fit to print.
Yeah.
All the news that's fit to print. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Well, I knew that, but I now really know it. But what was interesting, right? I went on one of these marches.
Yeah.
Down in London. The first one I went in April of 2021.
Okay.
The one I went on in the summer of 2021. Man, that was awesome.
Yeah.
There were 1.2 million people. In London.
Is that right?
The drone reports a week later came back with 1.2 million. I actually didn't march because I went around down with Tom and met his sister, and we stood on the corner of Pall Mall and just watched because I was waiting for a friend to come through, and we waited for 3 hours, and it was just thick.
Wow.
You know, there was no space with people. And ordinary people, it was peaceful, it was fun.
Yeah. Tell me, was that the one that the BBC reported as 200 people? Was that the one?
They didn't even report it. No.
But the ones that they did, it was like that, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is my point, right? I come back from London having seen 1.2 million souls. It's the biggest protest in the history of Britain, bigger than the anti-Gulf War protests.
Yeah.
And I come back to my friend who lives in the house and I says, I've just been down in London, right? I've just seen the biggest march of human souls. And I said, how come I've come back and the BBC hasn't mentioned it?
Yes.
And he said to me, he says, the government spoke to us 10 days ago and asked us not to cover it.
Oh, well, yeah.
So...
Yeah, well, obviously.
And I said to him, and how do you feel? Are you a journalist? You're proud of the name journalism, right? He just shrugged his shoulders. He's like, yeah. He was ashamed himself, really.
Yeah.
I think he left and went to GB News in the end. But and Sky News covered it and said there were like 10,000 people there. You know, and you just think, wow, it really is what you suspect. It's when you actually see it and you actually peel it away and know people in it and they admit it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, yeah, okay. It is true.
Mm.
Anyway, but the positive thing is it was so encouraging to meet so many people. Mm. I met a guy who had a pasty stall in Falmouth in Cornwall. He's just walking there with his two young kids. And we got chatting and talking. You know what? He wasn't a Christian, but he says he was really open. This whole thing had made him think about the meaning of life. Mm. And he was starting to read the Bible with his daughters. And he was really thinking of becoming a Christian. You know, just think, oh, man. But then not just that. There was people who weren't Christians. There was Buddhists and people who, you know, into all sorts of different things. And we just had a great time and had such a lot in common because the thing that mattered was humanity, what it means to be a human.
Right.
And all of them knew about transhumanism. All of them knew about the stuff that's going on with the vaccines. You know, they weren't judgmental of people who took them. But they were just saying something's seriously up here, you know. Mm. And it was just a joy to see humans coming together. That was the point. They weren't clones. They were so different, diverse, coming together peacefully.
Exactly.
And caring about what it means to be free as a human being. Mm. And you go back to the suburbs where you come from and you find everyone's just hiding. And you go to the Sainsbury's or something and they're looking at you strange because you're not wearing a mask or something. You know, it's just like they've seen an alien or something. And you're thinking, wow, yes. What a division. What's happened here? You know, it really is something else, man. Mm. Wow.
So when you were on these marches, you didn't see people with swastikas then, did you?
No. I tell you what you did see. You did see, obviously, people who were meant to be agitators, and they were clearly the police. Yeah. Because they had plain clothes, but they were, you know, when they wear plain clothes, they're not very plain clothes. They're like brand new, bought, you know. They're meant to look like some kind of guy with combat gear on, but it's all clean and brand new and everything. And you just can tell. And you'd go on different marches and you'd see them, the same people. So they're meant to be spying on us, but we can see them, you know. Mm. It happened one in Birmingham.
It's funny enough, it reminds me of... I had a friend who went to Albania back in the day when it was still a communist state, and to, you know, go for a walk in the park, and there would be these people with the same suit on who would be sort of loitering around, and they were the secret police. Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were supposed to be just a lot of business types, but they all had the same suits.
So, yeah.
That's an extreme example, but yeah, similar mentality, really.
That's so funny that they haven't kind of sussed that yet. Mm. I found it when we went to Birmingham. We went on a good march in Birmingham once, and that was great. And these guys managed to get to the front of it and split it off and take it down the Queensway, where there was going to be something kicking off down in the Queensway with the police and everything. And very quickly, people sussed it. The organizer of the march said, "Hey, wait a minute, there's something's going on here. This isn't not meant to happen. Everyone retreat, come back, and just get back on the normal march." And so you could see that there were agitators in there.
Yeah.
And the police working together to try and make it look bad.
Yeah.
My friend Sam, he had gone down to the very first marches in London. There was like only 500 to 1,000 people there, and they got clobbered by the police. They were just beat up.
Really?
You know, Boris's police beat them up. Right. But once the numbers got so big, they knew they couldn't do that.
Yeah.
It was just numbers.
Yeah.
So that just shows what your government's like. If you're small, they'll beat you up.
Yeah.
If you get too big, 10,000, 20,000, then they'll just, okay, leave it, you know. Because they know they can't cope with it. But isn't that horrible?
It is.
Isn't that bad? That's our government. How wonderful. We pay them, you know. We pay their wages.
Yes, they have our interests at heart, exactly. Of course, they really want to stop all this, don't they? So if they can control our means of exchange digitally, then they could just turn everything off when we want to get on the train to go to a protest. We just can't even get there in future. That's part of the paradigm, I'm quite sure.
Yeah, yeah. It's a bit like, I don't know if you watch Game of Thrones. I wouldn't recommend it. It's very pornographic and stuff.
Yeah.
But the story of that is the White Walk. Are coming from the north. Jon Snow, winter is coming. And it's like, that is kind of what's happening. I mean, you know, you've got all these 15-minute city things coming in. It's just from every angle. Every angle are coming at you. A digital currency, digital ID.
Yes.
But do you think they've been sped up a bit? Because we can see it clearly.
By what's happened? By COVID, you mean?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well,
yes.
Do you think that COVID finished too soon for them? They want to drag it out maybe for 5 years?
I suspect that's the case.
Yeah.
Because I still think Omicron is a mystery, remains a mystery as to where that came from.
Mm.
I think it's not impossible that that was... I don't like the phrase white hat, but everybody knows what I mean by that.
Mm.
I'm not into Q and all that, but nevertheless, yeah, I think it's possible. You know, I'm of the opinion that the Wuhan strain was, you know, an escape, at least.
Mm.
So I think it's possible that this was an answer to that. Or, well, yeah, okay, maybe it was a natural thing, but either way, I think it's providential that it happened, because that was the answer to what happened, rather than the vaccine rollout, which, of course, is normally given the credit for this.
Yeah.
I think had it not been for that, I think things would have become a lot worse, and I think we would have gone down the line of what Ursula von der Leyen, you know, was saying about, I think we need to have a conversation about mandatory vaccination across the EU, and then Boris echoing that and all that. Yeah, I think that all would have happened and was expected to happen. And it all went wrong for them. But I think there were a lot of vested interests that were salivating at the prospect of bringing all this stuff in more quickly. So I think, yes, I think you're absolutely right that it has speeded it all up, yeah.
Now, this is where it comes to the hopeful side of things. Mm. Have you ever read that book, That Hideous Strength, the C.S. Lewis? The trilogy?
I actually haven't. No, I haven't read that one. No.
Man, it gets so close, you see. It's very, very close. It's actually in a place like Oxford. And they're trying to kind of do this transhuman thing, but it's a globalist thing of control. And and they get so close, but then it all just crumbles at the very last. Just as they're reaching for the goal, it falls apart. And I do wonder if this kind of reset World Economic Forum thing might well have just played all its cards. And because this is what the thing is, they do fear the people. They always do. That is a big factor. Now, it looks like they've got all the cards. They've got all everything covered. We're going to be trapped.
Yeah.
But I do wonder, you know.
And I wonder whether this actually...
It's happened before, you know.
Yeah, this could be something where we differ theologically, but also agree in some ways theologically.
Right.
I think we have different views about the future. I don't know. Perhaps we'll go into that. But whatever, I think we could probably agree that... Let's say that I might look at this and say, well, yes, I can see that a lot of Christians think that what is happening in the world now is leading towards the Antichrist and the one world system and all that, and then have a sense of feeling, well, there's nothing we can do then because this is going to happen. You know,
just give up,
exactly. However, even though I am more of a futurist with respect to these things, nevertheless, I've never seen things that way. I've always thought, well, we don't know when it's going to happen. We don't know how bad it's going to be on the way to happening. So how do we know that this particular instance of global trends is going to lead directly to that? We don't know. We could think in terms of peaks and troughs. Maybe this is a certain peak where we may have a trough where things calm down and there's stability for maybe decades, and then something else happens, and okay, eventually I think it will lead in that direction and then Christ will return. But how can I, you know, looking back at history, as you were saying, how can I look at this, even though it's very suspicious, this seems to fit with a lot of things that people are worried about, myself included. We don't actually know, and therefore we can play our part in doing everything that we can to ensure that another trough happens rather than this peak turn into the end. You know what I mean? We don't know. We don't know what God's timetable is with this. So in that sense, I'm quite hopeful that if enough people become aware of what's going on and resist, then maybe this particular instance will, you know, drop off.
Well, you know,
that's my way of viewing it.
That's a really good point. I'm with you. I think I'm the same place as you in that sense. I wasn't perhaps in the past. I was probably black-pilled into inactivity and just moaning about what's coming. And it's easy to do that.
Yeah.
That's easy. You know, that doesn't require much effort. You can just look at things and go, oh, well, I was all going to hell in a handbag, and oh, dear.
That's right.
Oh, Jesus, and it, better come and help us.
Yeah, and it can make you immediately look at things like that. Sorry, we're talking. This is what happens with these interviews.
Sorry,
you know, no.
Yeah, sorry,
I interrupted you. So go on.
No. Look, I witness in just ordinary life. I witness people who are awakening, you know, to what's going on in the world. But also on a smaller level, I work sometimes with people who are in the justice system. You know, that you know, I'm probation. You know, and I meet guys who discovered Jordan Peterson and they want to make something of their life.
Yeah.
You know, these are people who have been stuck on Red Bull, porn, weed and computer games. And they now want to make something of their life because they've realised that actually they were made to live a meaningful life.
It is remarkable what he's doing, actually.
Oh, man.
I don't know quite where he stands in terms of actual belief in God, but he seems incredibly close. I don't know whether he's perhaps, you know, he believes more than he's actually revealing. I don't know. A lot of people speculate about this. But what he's doing is remarkable, changing people's view of the world, for sure.
Yeah, and you can't underestimate that. If you think about what happened with the Gulag Archipelago with, you know, Alexander Sitchenitsyn, he just wrote a book in that dark situation. It got smuggled out. That was the end of the Soviet Union, beginning of the end of the communist system. So, you know, your little things are important if it's to do with truth. And it's about truth, isn't it? Because that's what affects the culture. You know, we're talking about politics and power and economy and stuff, but really it's about what people think of themselves. People in communist countries were so desperate to hear about freedom and about God and stuff. It was like water to, you know, a dry tongue. It was like, you know, please tell us more about this Jesus and stuff. This is after that, you know, things came down. And humans can only go on so long, you know, thinking life's pointless before they get hungry. And I think a lot of young people are starting to kind of rebel against the system, the culture they've been fed and given.
Yeah.
You know, there are no taboos left anymore. So people are actually more attracted to virtue. It's in fact, when everybody's actually a rebel or a revolutionary, the only real revolutionary thing to be is a traditionalist.
Yes. Yes, I've had that thought a few times as well. Yes, how can you be rebellious here?
Yeah.
Go to church. Wow, that's really subversive. Sorry.
Yeah, think about God. Think about meaning, truth, goodness, and beauty.
No, honestly, I mean, this is a very simple example, but we tend to say grace at mealtime. And I often say, actually, do you know, for most people, this would be considered a very, these days, quite a subversive thing to do. And if you did that out in public, you know, people could object, you know, yet it's something traditional. It's flipped on its head, absolutely. I wanted to bring you back, actually, to something you said near the beginning of our conversation.
Yeah.
You know, you were having that pressure from your employer.
Yeah.
This is before even the government decided to mandate all this business for NHS workers and connected workers. But you said in the notes to me that you'd had a brush with death a few years before that, that kind of prepared you for the difficulties connected with that. Do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, right. Yeah, this is the trick. In 2017, I went for a basic routine operation on my nose, which is like a septoplasty operation, because I had issues with an allergy. And I've never been able to breathe through my nose because of a couple of rugby injuries when I was younger, you know, the cartilage and everything. Yeah. And so, you know, and the doctor said, well, I'll tell you what, I can't get rid of your allergy, but I can give you, we can open up passageways. So I went for this routine half an hour operation. Came out, thought everything's fine, blood's coming out your nose for a few days and you've got to take whatever. And anyway, I go home and I've got a fever. And I think, well, of course I've got a fever. I'm reacting to a thing that just happened. And the fever carries on. And then suddenly my foot starts really hurting.
Your foot?
And I'm thinking, if I've trodden a nail or something. Yeah. And then I look at it and it's this little pinprick thing. And then like an hour later, it's got bigger and bigger. And before I know it, my foot's going black, you know.
Oh, gosh.
And I go to the A&E and they go, wait a minute, you just had that into your nose. This is like 36 hours after the op. And they go, oh, Flip, you've got sepsis.
Oh, wow.
And it took them a while to get to find an antibiotic. So, yeah, and then they were going to, they were saying, right, we're going to have to chop your leg off because you're going to die, you know. What happened was Staph aureus, which is in your belly button, up your nose. So all, we don't test for it because it's completely safe if it doesn't get into your bloodstream. But obviously through the operation, it had got into my bloodstream. But it had avoided my heart and gone straight to a weak point, obviously, on my foot, and then worked from there. You know, absolute agony, you know.
Gosh.
And then, so for the first week, you know, I was just delirious. But then, and they were basically saying, you're going to die.
They actually said, well, they said that?
Well, my family were saying that's what they were saying. Oh, you know, this is serious, this is death. Because most people die of sepsis once they get their blood infected. And my organs were starting to crank and I was going green, you know. And so I was starting to think, well, all right then, I'm a believer in Jesus, so I'm going to die. That's that. And then after 2 weeks, it managed to turn a corner and they got an antibiotic and it seemed to turn things. Then it was like an 8-month recovery after that.
Gosh,
and that, yeah, oh, look, why did it take that to make me realise something I knew anyway, which is that we're all going to die, you know. Wow. But what
we know that, don't we? But we don't internalise that. You know?
No.
I mean, I didn't realise it was quite that severe. I mean, you said you'd had a problem with your foot. That was some problem with your foot.
No. Okay. It was sepsis. And what happens when you do these things, you start looking into it and you start reading all the other people, you know, all the headlines about people who've died of sepsis and stuff. Yeah. Anyway, something happened in me there. And it kind of coincided with me kind of changing my perspective on eschatology. That was already going on.
Okay.
But it also made me think, you know, look, I've got lots of friends who believe in the end times and the rapture and, you know, and all these events that are going to line up and stuff. And it matters such a lot. People go, listen to things about it and read books about it. And I was thinking, I know loads of these people, they're dead now. And I'll bet wherever they are now, which I know where they are, they're in the unseen realm, they're with Jesus. I bet they're not talking about those things and reading those books anymore. And it doesn't matter, right? Because it just doesn't matter, right? So that was one thing that changed my thought. Well, whatever I think, it's not that important because I could just die, you know, get hit by a bus.
I see.
You know, and what difference would it make knowing all these intricate details, which everyone agrees that they disagree about, right? So, you know, but that was that.
So you're addressing a sort of becoming too obsessed with all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got to admit, I'm not actually that obsessed with
this kind of,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So hold it lightly.
Okay.
Cause it's not good for your health, you know? But the other side was, you know, I realized in life that I had a lot of fears, you know, of people, of situations, social situations, fears of, in my existential fears, fears of failing, fears of being revealed, you know, found out for being the moron that I am or something, you know, and all those kinds of things, you know. And I think that was really good because I realised that if I was dead, I wouldn't be here to worry about those things and have those fears.
Yes, I see what you mean.
Because there's no one here to fear those things. And life, they would carry on and that thing would carry on. So I just thought, well, I'll do a trick here. And it's really obvious. I'll just live and not be afraid. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It sounds so simple, but it's like, it's so true.
It immediately connects to what Paul says about, you know, having died to your old life and being now alive in Christ.
Yeah.
Okay, poetic language, but nevertheless, we know the kind of thing it means. And this seems to be an actual example of that happening to you, a realization that you could live that way.
Yeah.
I've often thought of that. I don't think it's ever been as stark as your experience, but that sense of, yeah, okay, if I conceive of myself as already dead, that is dead to my old self, then I am now alive in a new way. I'm alive in a way that anticipates resurrection.
Mm.
That's what Paul is thinking of course.
Mm.
There's a freedom in that thought, but I don't think I've risen to the heights of your experience where you can take that thought and actually live through that on a day-by-day basis.
Well,
employer challenges you in that way, you can feel a freedom about it, because that's what you seem to imply, that you did feel a certain freedom in that.
Well, I think, I'm going to have a near-death experience to get here, but you can actually think, wait a minute, what's the worst thing if I lose this thing, this important money or something, or lose this job, or lose this prestige, or lose this... What's the worst? If I lose everything, how bad is that? I mean, can I live with losing everything? And if you think you can, and the worst possible thing that can happen to you, and you can cope with that, that is so liberating.
Mm.
And that's why you can just go, right, and your principles can be like, well, I'm not buying that. I'm not having that off you. Thank you, but no, thank you. And they'll be left aghast going, what idiot would turn that down this side of eternity? And you're going, because it's wrong.
Yeah,
I end up 30 grand poorer, but I haven't been bought off.
I've
remained the autonomous human being that God made in God's image that he wants me to be. These are really profound things.
Yes. But it seems to me that you reached an accommodation with that way of thinking more easily because of your experience than I did. I wasn't challenged in the same kind of way, but I imaginatively challenged myself because of the fact that I was not taking these injections, and yet we were seeing what was happening in Austria and threatened in Germany, and people were talking in terms of, you know, people like is it Neil Oliver and others were saying, you know, we maybe find ourselves losing our property or as a consequence of these decisions. And I was thinking, yeah, they're going to be fined in Austria. Could we go through a series of fines and perhaps prison sentences and think, you know, am I ready for this?
I know.
And I think I did say to myself and to God, yeah, I'm going to stand this ground.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that I felt as comfortable, is not the word, ready for it as you were, because I'd not experienced what you had. I think that's fair to say.
Maybe that's true.
I think I was more fearful.
I think there's something that happens when you're faced. It must be like, I imagine it's what it's like. It was like for Jesus or Paul or something like that, when they get called before authorities or the Sanhedrin. It's very daunting. It is. You can't pretend it's not. You can't go, oh, I'm cool about this. Hey, nothing affects me. No, it's the fact that you are scared, but you stand.
Sure.
That's what courage is, really. It's not that you have no fear. It's that you confront your fear. You face the fear, you know.
Right. Well, at the top of the show, as the phrase goes, you mentioned how your theology had not changed, but had broadened, had deepened.
Yeah.
And I noticed that as part of your responses to things that we've been talking about, you know, you have said the unseen realm a number of times. Of course, that connects immediately to Mike Heiser's work, of course, who, as most listeners will probably know, died recently, which, of course, you know, is very sad. But then he's in glory. He's in the unseen realm, so we can rejoice in that sense.
Yeah, man.
But, you know, lost to the world because although he leaves, of course, a tremendous body of work, and particularly, you know, that Naked Bible podcast, which I've learned a lot from.
Mm.
And, you know, I have my own questions about his view of things, but I have benefited from that, and they are ongoing questions. Has helped me with interpreting the Old Testament to some extent. So anyway, this has informed you and changed your view of things a little. So do you want to tell us how that has been relevant to you and is continuing to be relevant as we try to live in this new old normal?
I think it's amazing, really, how it's coincided in a way, that a kind of deeper, richer, wider understanding. Not just Mike Heiser, I'm thinking of like Tim Mackey with the Bible Project, who I know is actually kind of on the same page as Michael Heiser and N.T. Wright and stuff like that. So this kind of understanding of the a deeper understanding of what the gospel is, which is that God has become king, and what that means for us as humans. And I've liked this idea of looking at the big picture, stepping outside, and I think I have an advantage because I'm dyslexic, right? And dyslexics are very good at seeing patterns, not so good at drilling down on details, but seeing the overall thing. And I was thinking, what was God's original plan, right? His original plan when he made humans. He created man, breathed his spirit, his ruach into him, and he became a living soul, it says, and whatever. And then, what does he want us to do? Because I sometimes think, gosh, do Christians, well, do I really think why we're made? What are we here for? What was the point? You know, and the more I've understood, just delved into the Old Testament more to understand the nature of God, because I used to think, well, it's just God's one thing on his own. Well, all right, there's the Spirit and there's the Son, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. There's the Trinity, right? And no one understands that because it's all a bit wee and wacky and stuff. And when he says, let us make man in our image and stuff like that, I'm just thinking, well, yeah, it could just be God speaking within himself. But, you know, when the Queen says, let us build a castle or something, you know, or let us do that kind of thing. She doesn't lift a finger, right? She doesn't lift a trowel or a brick, but she builds it. Her subjects build it. She involves her subjects with those things, and they have free will, and they can suggest ideas, and she can say, well, that's a good idea. I'll do that. That's what I was going to do, but I'm glad you participated in that, and you've added. And so I'm starting to think that why he made creatures, why would God make us? Right, why would he make angels? Why would he make humans? Why would he make divine beings, cherubim, seraphim? Yes. But, you know, it can't just be a vanity project, you know. So I'm thinking, why did he make man? And it looks like he made us to be independent, but like him, to go and do stuff. I was thinking of when he told us, told Adam to name things. Hmm. I see that as a very divine attribute. God names things. He names the stars, he names this and that, and says it's good and stuff. And then he creates a human, and he says, you go do what I do, and you name the animals. So I'm now thinking, well, we're made to be like God, to go do stuff. And also, it looks like we were to have dominion, which was to stop any dangerous stuff coming in, to contaminate the paradise that is. And, you know, at some point that went wrong.
Yeah.
But
this all sounds fairly conventional, Andy.
I know.
What about the angels? It's still a mystery to me as to why God would make angels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, you know, Mike Kaiser's work helps me in reading a passage, you know, like that. Mysterious thing in Genesis that you brought up there. So I can read that and think, oh, yeah, okay, so the divine council view of that makes sense of let us do this and let us do that as a kind of ancient worldview way of talking about God amongst other small g gods, as it were, in a council, as a sort of picture borrowed from the king speaking to his...
Obviously, it's a picture, isn't
his subjects who would go out and do his work, etc.
Yeah.
But how literally to take that is still a question in my mind. As an interpretative tool, very helpful. So I don't have to think, oh yes, that's just the Trinity there being referred to in an Old Testament text, which is very unlikely to be the case. But the hermeneutical questions, what to do with that? What kind of genre is this? What was it saying and what is it saying now? These are very different questions and leave me still thinking, what are angels all about, you know?
Well, if they're extra dimensional beings, then we can't really understand it because we're not seeing it in that extra dimension. So it's from our angle, hard to see through a glass darkly. From that angle, they can probably, you can take a step down a dimension and look down our way, but it's hard for us to go up the extra. That's what I think.
Sure.
But anyway, I'm thinking God made us and we were part of his divine council, part of his family. So I think God wants us in his family. And he's made us be in his family, but he's also created us with free will. And he couldn't make us robots. He would be evil if he did that. It's a funny, strange thing. Well, why hasn't God done something about evil? Well, he would be evil if he manipulated and controlled people to not have free will. So virtue is something you have to want. You can't make you virtuous because you're not virtuous if you're made to be virtuous.
Absolutely.
Right. So these are really important things. These are very pivotal things. I think these aren't little discussions that are theology. This is about the very existence of existence, what it means to exist. Is virtue important? Is love important or not? So this is what it all plays out into the kind of Lord of the Rings scenario we find ourselves in now, you know, this year, 2023. So it's pivotal how we see the meaning of life, how we see God, how we see ourselves and what we're made to be. And I think that's what's wonderful about the gospel. It's helped us to know that. So I'm thinking the plan A was make humans, go out and fill the earth with his kingdom. That's still his plan. And he hasn't got a plan B, as Michael Heiser says. There's only plan A. And it's not going to be frustrated in the end, although it's a big chess game and there is an adversary who's seeking to ruin that and there are creatures with free will who want to go against that because they've chosen for some reason. So I'm just very excited at the overall view and what Jesus achieved when he came. And Paul says he's the second Adam. So it's this plan A again, plan A 2.0. And so with that mindset, I'm starting to understand that there's an intent. There has to be an intentionality about our lives. Jesus was intentional about how he operated. Adam was intentional to go and do those things to fill the earth with God's kingdom. And it seems like throughout time, through all the narratives of Noah and of Abraham, God has always started with someone to continue this plan, which is to fill the earth with his kingdom, to Edenify it. Because originally we were to take Eden to the world,
okay,
to bring heaven and earth to the world. This idea of heaven and earth. Yeah.
It's interesting you talk about this plan A business, but coming at this from a completely different angle, reading the work of Alvin Plantinga, so, you know, okay, as a philosopher, he will say some things that connect with this in the sense that, you know, God chooses a possible world, and this is a possible world. And why does he choose this one rather than another one? World means, you know, the whole history of a universe or even multiverse, you know, from beginning to end. It's all possibilities within this world. He's chosen this rather than another world. And part of that, of course, is the coming of Christ.
Yeah.
And the bringing in eventually of the kingdom and the new heaven and the new earth. This is all something that's chosen. So there isn't a plan B as if thing, oh, well, God didn't realize things would go wrong and then he had to change his mind about things and bring in plan B to put things right. No, the whole thing is chosen out of a notional infinity of possible worlds.
Right.
And he instantiates this. So that fits very much with what you're saying.
And yeah,
rather than things going wrong and changes of plan, it's a world with a certain contour that you can trace throughout from beginning to end. And God has chosen that whole contour.
And I think Tolkien understood this with Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And I think that there's a lot more to Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion. And it's really a parable of the gospel. But you don't get it because it's a parable. Because you're not meant to get it straight away. You can get it if you want to get it, if you can think that way. Some people love the Lord of the Rings so much. People don't believe in God. They love the Lord of the Rings because it's of God. And that's how parables work. That's how God speaks. So anyway, if you have the wrong view of the gospel, how you think is how you act, isn't it? So
yes. It
often leads to how you perceive yourself. Your identity is really important. So like you see it in families. If someone doesn't really feel like they belong in a family, it's messy. They have an awkward walk in life. And I think spiritually, knowing we belong just through faith, not works, through faith in believing and trusting in the one in Creator God, in God, that we're in the family. And just through faith, we're accounted as righteous like Abraham was, just because we believe and trust his character.
You believed that before, though, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
You believed that before, though, Andy. So what's changed?
It's just deepened. It's just like I realised that I'm actually a member of a big family. A big council. It's just filled out, that's all. It's just got more depth to it. There's more people on the stage. But knowing that then informs, how do I explain it? You know, you can get quite placky as a Christian, just going through the motions and just perhaps doing things because you think you ought to, because it's what you do. It can become cultural. Or how do I explain it? I think God wants us to love him because we want to love him. He wants us to like him. I wonder if people really like God or their idea of God. I was thinking, do I like Jesus? I was thinking, I really do like Jesus, you know. I mean, I could love him and not like him and think, well, I love Jesus, but there's some things I've got a problem. I have a real problem with that, what he said and stuff. But I really do like him. You know, it's that kind of love. And I think to like God, I think if you interpret the Bible incorrectly, you could actually end up believing in God but not liking him because you've not got the context. And this is why I'm excited about reading the Bible in context. And that's what's been really good from Michael Heiser and stuff. Because I think if you don't read it in context, you can get really screwed up. You know, you've got to do the legwork to find out who's written by, why, who to, what's the cultural context. All those things have really helped me. So I've gone deep digging. But as a result of the digging, the deep theology and all this stuff, it's become really simple. And it's just that you have faith in God. And that's why I just want to sing disco songs about Jesus.
About God. It's interesting because I get the impression, I've got the impression over the years, you know, preaching around this area that a lot of people are actually a bit scared about going into the background behind the New Testament and the Old Testament, as if they're going to discover things that are going to unseat their faith. And I suppose if you go to a certain kind of library, you're going to find that's the case. But there's a lot of fantastic scholarship out there, which means you don't you don't have to go down that super skeptical line. You know, you can actually read all of it and still come away with your faith intact and enriched, in fact.
Well, some people have deconstructed in their faith. because they've had a rigid evangelical or maybe a fundamentalist, like Bart Ehrman. You know, they have a really a strict kind of brittle perspective on the Bible. Yes. And then when something comes along, a curveball comes along, some academic thing says, oh, actually, this was from this and this is this and whatever.
Yeah.
And they go, right, my whole system's collapsing. And they deconstruct. But I do think there's something good about deconstructing to reconstruct. And I think it should kind of go on all the time in your faith. But if it has to come as like some bomb at some point in your life, and I'm noticing some people are doing that. They kind of can't keep on going on the fumes of just simple evangelical Christianity. This is why I don't think the current McDonaldization of Christianity, although it might appeal, but it's not long-term appealing. The gospel's so deep and rich. So it's just a tragedy, really. And I do see people deconstructing and running away, and then they'll later come back to God because they know it's true, but they might come through a different kind of angle on it. And so I'm not so sure. I mean, I've never really been in churches, like kind of denominations. I've got a couple for a bit, but generally I've met in houses and we just got around the Bible and had tea and cake and a laugh, right? And to be honest with you, I've just missed all the problems that you get from structured kind of situations. And I actually think that the Spirit of God can operate in small little groups much more easily. Obviously, it has its downsides as well. Yeah.
Oh, well, I haven't missed those problems. I've missed those problems recently because I haven't been going back to church very much, as listeners will know.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are huge problems. I mean, nearly everything that we've talked about here today, I can't really think of more than one or two people who I could have a similar conversation with.
Right.
And then not everything that we've talked about even then.
Yeah.
Quite dispiriting, really.
Yet I will talk with people who have been to prison and they're much more liberated because they've had time to think. And they're more up to talking about existence of God, and they'll talk about what the state of the world, what's going on. I met people on the marches that weren't believers, but they had all the same concerns and perspectives. Yeah. And some of them had like esoteric kind of, they would like say into worshipping Egyptian gods or something or whatever. But let me say, you know, they have the same ancient worldview that I now have. So I can actually talk and understand instead of in the past of go, roll the eyes and get the crucifix out. Right. No, this is great because we're talking on the same level. We're talking on the level of like, oh, we're understanding the ancient worldview. And actually, I've been able to talk about things like Elohim, you know, God being Elohim, which is a plural word for an address. It's more of a postcode of where divine beings exist, except Yahweh Elohim is the God of gods.
Fascinating.
It's actually called that in the Bible, God of gods, right? But little g gods.
Yeah.
I know we don't like that, but it's your Bible, right? Get used to your Bible.
That's a very, very interesting in that you have with a conversation like that. I'm finding similar things, not with the Mike Kaiser stuff as it happens, but...
No.
I just want to give a bit of context to my chuckle there. It was more of an affectionate recognition chuckle than one of derision, because I've spoken to lots of people about all kinds of weird stuff, and it was that making you think, I recognise that. But the experience has been overwhelmingly positive because then you find that things open up in conversation that wouldn't in a quote-unquote normal social context. It's been remarkable. How could I end up talking to somebody about flat earth and not closing down the conversation, but having a chat about what does that actually mean, and finding in some cases that they're using flat earth as a symbol for meaning. Which is extraordinary. They'll talk about flat earth, but actually, no, this is to do with we've been lied to about so much, so the flat earth is a symbol of the truth that's been hidden in so many ways.
Right.
Gosh, I'd never have had that conversation with somebody had it not been for both of us, both parties to this conversation being open in a new way. So I recognise what you mean.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got a friend who's Buddhist, and we went on the march. We just had great conversations. You know, I want to learn. I want to learn about Buddhism. I want to know what he's taught and stuff. I know a little bit. And then I can, because I know that my worldview of Yahweh is brilliant. And it's like, there's going to be truths in those things, although they won't lead to the ultimate epitome of it in Jesus.
Yes,
but absolutely. It doesn't mean you, honestly, there's such, people are thinking of concepts in Buddhism or something like that, or Socrates kind of thinking. And it's just one step away from having it fully realized in Jesus. So it's like, it's very exciting.
Yeah, it's incredible. I have an experience of speaking to somebody every other week or so about Hinduism.
Yeah.
Yet so many of the thoughts that he has, he's a very well-read and intelligent man, are so close. In fact, he calls himself a Christian. Of course, I will say the sticking point is the atonement, for example, and the exclusivity of Christ. But there are so many similarities, you know, who actually believe in resurrection.
Where?
And believe in the scriptures being a vehicle of the word of God.
Yeah.
These sorts of things. He has respect for the New Testament and the Old Testament. We can have conversations like this and, you know, quite outspoken conversations so that people can hear what's being said.
Right.
And I have that sense that God is being glorified in that conversation in front of the audience of unbelievers around us in the pub or wherever it is. And that whole experience I would never have had prior to the last few years and what's happened.
Yes.
Extraordinary to actually shake hands with somebody who doesn't actually believe the gospel, but we have so much in common that the differences are not irrelevant, but they're placed into second place while we have this friendly and meaningful conversation. And who knows what will come out of that, both for us as people in the conversation and people listening in, you know. Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Well, I mean, I often wonder what it's like for people looking in at Christianity. If you just go on the internet, and you'd think we're nuts, right? You'd think you'd be a nutter to become a Christian because there's some crazy stuff there, right? So you've got to sympathise with people. You know, why would you join that group? They're all arguing about something like Mary Poppins' rapture thing, you know, about when it'll happen. Will it on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, you know? And that's not edifying, you know? And they see that. And the Christians are scratching their heads going, I can't understand why people don't take this seriously. Whereas actually there are bigger things that are much more important. I've got a friend.
Yes.
She was a Buddhist for 25 years, and the whole pandemic has led her to God. So she was like, had a master and everything, all the books. She took it seriously. And during the pandemic, and it was because we talked about things like the divine counsel and that. And she had a need during this time to pray to someone, and obviously in Buddhism there isn't anyone to pray to, even though she loved being a Buddhist, and so she needed Jesus, and she called out to him, and then she's now a believer, beautiful believer. She's like a strong believer, you know, she's just like a discerning, strong believer, and happy. And then another guy, that guy that I was talking about, he was reading the book of Daniel. We were sitting in the car, and he says, I just finished reading the book of Daniel. It's like, he wasn't a Christian then. He ran a shop that sold like essential, you know, oils and stuff and kind of new age trinkets and things and stuff like that and crystals and things. And then he was just open-minded and he just finished reading the whole of the Bible and he's become a believer, you know, slowly but surely. It was all, you know, I think the whole pandemic caused him to think,
Absolutely. Yeah, I've heard so many people say that.
There's something going on here. There's an evil force going on here. How does that fit into my worldview?
Yes, so many people
have said that. We forget about that. James Dellingpole.
Go on.
If you can see his change, he goes from being, you know, who he was to this guy says, I can't believe it, you know, the world's run by Satanists and God's really cool. You know, that's kind of his thing, isn't it? He's like, you know, because he realized there was a dark force, and he thought, well, what worldview can actually cope with this idea of some adversary, some kind of satanic, non-physical, evil force behind these people?
I have come across that view many times. Before, you know, people would talk in terms of evil, and if they did, well, they'd sort of say, well, you know, evil, that's a bit sort of supernaturally, won't go there. Whereas over the last few years, it's been a case of actually speaking directly about evil in those terms, as if it is something that is behind the scenes that's motivating what's going on.
And what's the answer
to that? Christ, of course, is the counter answer to that, of course.
Yeah. And here's the beauty of it, is the gloves are off, and you can actually understand what evil is, and it's what's been done to you. It's like manipulation, control, lying. You know, I think we've come out of postmodern age. That's the trouble. Postmodernism softened us up for all this. The idea there was no truth. Well, it also meant there's no such thing as a lie. Because there's nothing, right?
Right.
And I think people have woken up and been bitten the bum and realised there is lies. There is. We're feeling the actual pain of it.
Yes.
So as long as these are all just discussions and academic, you know, things you can talk about over a coffee, now it's actually hitting the consequences, the feeling the pain. And so it's not until people feel the pain they actually think, right, okay, oh, okay, I'm waking up now. So it's good in a way.
It is good. Now, this comes to one of the things that's constantly bothering me about the institutional church.
Yeah.
I'm dipping back into the work of Francis Schaeffer here, because he always used to say, you know, the church gets onto the latest idea 40 years after it was the latest idea. And I have that sense that this is what the church is doing. You know, the institutions of the church doing now is going all postmodern, is going all woke, etc.
And that's
already passé. You know, that's it's the last guest to the dinner, as it were. And you're talking already in you know, we're beyond that. We've seen through that, and people are already trying to find, well, okay, what's the answer to all this? This is not the answer in itself. There must be something beyond all this, which is giving us the opportunity to have the conversations that we're having. But I'm looking back at the church services just locally and thinking, ah, you know, they're talking in these sorts of postmodernish, wokeish ways about the latest thing and be more concerned about climate change and whatever you think about that. Nevertheless, it's that's not what church is all about, is it? You know,
It never was. It just got exposed.
Okay, so there's this divide, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm finding it impossible to conceive, even now, even though I've thought about it a lot, you know, of going back into that situation in a serious, committed way and feeling happy within that context, because it's another world. It's another reality that I feel I've gone beyond. I can't imagine myself taking the blue pill, as it were, and going back into that situation and just living a normal Christian life, worshipping, preaching, in that context.
No.
I don't do the Bible study anymore that we had for, was it 2 decades? Mm. I can't conceive of doing that again now.
No.
Because I wouldn't be speaking the same language.
Yeah, right.
There may be other people in the church who feel the same way, but you know you have to have a shared language within a community, don't you? Otherwise you get the raised eyebrow, etc.
Yeah.
So you can't get past that.
It must be that you're in more of a kind of establishment. Your experience is that, whereas it's a place of fellowship. It's not like a church, it's like in a house.
Yeah.
But it's 50-50. Half of them thought that God had blessed the world with Bill Gates, you know, and the vaccine, and the other half thought it was the mark of the beast. You know, which are.
You know, hold on, I don't want to give the impression that I'm, you know, very traditionalist.
You're not, but you're in a system that is.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm just give a little bit of autobiography here. You know, I was an atheist and I got converted into the charismatic scene in the late 1980s and then got involved in house churches.
Oh, right.
I was brought up as a Methodist, so I had, you know, a Methodist membership, which was always there. And I had this sense that I was called to preach. And so the most obvious thing to do was to go back into the Methodist church and preach and try to do some good.
Mm.
And I did that for, you know, a decade and a half.
Oh, wow.
So in a sense, not really part of, it sort of became part of the system of that, but was never really happy with it. There was always a tension on all kinds of issues. But I did what I did, you know, and I spoke the truth as I believed it to be. And that caused trouble at times, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So it's not as if this is new for me,
no.
This dissatisfaction and this frustration. It's just heightened now to such a level that I feel it's impossible for me to go back and do what even I was doing before, you know.
Mm.
There's a picture of me, just to make it clearer for you.
No. I know who you are. I know what you're like. I mean, and sometimes just the pond you're in, that's the thing. It can be difficult. Because I know lots of people are in churches, but they don't want to be there. They wouldn't choose to be there, but they're there because they feel they have to be, because they're doing something to help those people because it's in a mess.
And there is fellowship.
Yeah, yeah.
There is fellowship and there is spiritual support and a lot of good is done, etc.
Yeah.
There are problems.
I know. I've thought this for a long time. I think generally churches are out of touch, only because I meet so many people who are interested in God, but they wouldn't dream of going to a church, but they're on the internet and they're learning. They'll sit and watch a 2-hour video on ancient scrolls or something or something like that that's really interesting. And I think the gospel is so interesting, and I think the truth of the Bible is so interesting.
Yeah.
That to go to a church and hear a few, sing a few songs and have a 2-3 point sermon, it just isn't cutting it. People are much more, they require more than that.
Yes.
I think the church has just been left behind, and now the tail's wagging the dog if you're an institutional church, because you need your money, so you need the, you know, charity status, and you need, if you're the Church of England, obviously you get money from, you know, elsewhere. And so if the Church of England was really into all the things it's making out it's into woke-wise, it would have done it 50 years ago.
Right.
But it's pitiful. It's doing it because it has to do it, and everyone knows it, and no one respects them for it. It's just pitiful. Yeah. It's a little old lady sitting in the corner drinking sherry. That's all it is. It's a C of E.
Look, I think you might have exaggerated, but I know what you mean.
Well, it epitomises the whole thing, because it's just, you know, it's on life support, isn't it? Like, you know, I went to a relative's C of E church recently, and the vicar guy, great guy, he previously just worked in like kind of charities with kids and done all sorts of building projects and all sorts of stuff and everything. So he when he became a vicar, he was like already, he wasn't really very vicarish, but he was saying COVID's destroyed It's all over. No one's come to church.
Really?
We're having to do things to make people interested that aren't really to do with the gospel. It's just like community stuff and everything.
Yes.
And he says it's just dusty old buildings. They're lovely buildings, but they all need loads of work on them. And people aren't coming. So he says it's kind of over. But he said the future of Christianity is brilliant. But not in this situation.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, he was like me. He was like, he can see the future of the gospel.
Yes.
And the truth of God, but not this.
Yes.
It's just a relic. So I think that's true.
But what does it actually look like in practice? This is what I'm still struggling with. I still feel hopeful that God is doing something, for sure.
It always... So
for example, completely weird. A few weeks ago, talking to a couple of people, there were three of us at the table. This is, just, you know, stand in the park. We were at Wetherspoons. There's a little advert for Wetherspoons. and we were talking about God and various things and the church and... I just thought, I'll go for it. I'll just say, hey, why don't we make a church?
Right.
Neither of them are actually believers, you know, not believers in the full gospel, but they both kind of believe in God. And the conversation didn't go that far to become, you know, a practical reality. But just the very fact that I felt I could say that. Why do you know? You believe in God. I believe in God. We may have some differences of opinion. We could form a church, couldn't we? And they didn't say, oh, no, I'm not interested in that. It was more, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. What do you have to... You know, what do you have to believe for that? And so we did have a bit of a conversation about that. So I don't know where that will lead, if it will lead anywhere, but the very fact that conversation took place is remarkable and makes me feel, I don't know what God is doing, but God is surely doing something.
Well, I think he is.
That something like that could even be a reality. I've never experienced anything like that, you know, since 1986 when I became a Christian until now.
Right. Well, my friend... She said, look, Andy, should we just get together? Because we need to. It was during lockdowns and we weren't allowed to meet. So we thought, well, let's meet then. Okay. And we called it Like-Minded Folk. It was just round at her house and some of her friends, some of my friends and some other people that just met on marches.
Yeah.
It was a great network. And we just turn up on I think it's every 2 weeks on a Thursday at the house. And we'd just talk about stuff. Someone might say, hey, watch this video about this or something, whatever. But we had good talks. We had good fun. And everyone was so desperate to talk and communicate. Because I think the whole lockdown and the pandemic thing brought up the subject of meaning. What's the meaning of life? What's it mean to be a human? Because this is clearly not what it means. So what does it mean? You know, is there meaning? Is there a purpose? And so it was good in that sense for some people. Obviously, for some people, it wasn't. You know, some people reacted differently. But a lot of people did. I saw that obviously at the marches. Thads, you know, million and whatever people. And that's just the people who turned up. You know, people don't turn up to these things who feel just the same.
That's a good point.
So I'm very hopeful. And I wonder, because the thing is, if you silence your enemy, you cannot hear them coming.
Yes.
So the fact that all the platforms, all the bullhorns were removed from anybody, and only given to a select few with one narrative, doesn't mean that those people don't exist anymore. They're all ready to go. They're all ready to march tomorrow as soon as something kicks off. They'll just be triggered.
Yeah.
As soon as it's something like the digital passports or something, and it's suddenly like, no, they'll be there. And it's not, I know this because it's not just in our country. It's across the world.
Well, that's certainly good to hear when you get reports saying, you know, half of the population is quite happy with digital ID. But then looking on the bright side, there's another half, I suppose.
There you go. Then.
Quiet. At the moment, you're quite right. I'd be on that march as well, indeed.
And there were people down Oxford. I didn't go, unfortunately. But down Oxford, you know, against the 15-minute cities, you know, the idea of...
Yes, yes.
It just seems everything that's beautiful about life is being ruined by the elite.
Yes,
you know,
it does.
Everything about your life is just like... Not for them, but for us. And I think people will see it. Mm. I mean, even if they do or don't... Obviously, that's a pragmatic thing about politics and living a nice life. But... We're talking spiritually, aren't we? What it means to be, who tells you what to do? And I'd never looked into this thing about the common law and the straw man thing.
No, I haven't.
I always thought, it's a bit wacky and a bit woo. But I've met a lot of people and have explained it. And our country, the Magna Carta, had, you know, the common law still stands. It's just that we've forgotten. And the people who are in charge are doing things that are actually illegal. Our government are corrupt and they are illegal. They might not think they are, but they are technically illegal against the law of this country and the citizens. And so I'd go to these kind of meetings, these truth juice meetings and stuff, or various other meetings arranged by people who weren't Christians, but they were like concerned about these issues. They were concerned about sovereignty. They were concerned about the rule of law. And the only place, it turns out, you can get your freedom from is a creator. So these are people who don't believe in God, the Bible, Jesus, but they know their only hope, according to common law, is the creator, because he's the one who gives us our inalienable rights.
Yes.
And I just thought, that's so profound.
It is profound, and I've never really understood just natural rights in some sort of Platonic sense, how that really makes any sense. Because why should anybody respect those rights, okay? They just sort of exist in some weird Platonic mathematical space, perhaps. Why would they even do that? But even if they do, why should you take any notice of that? But if, of course, it's the creator of all things, then that's rather different prospect there. Because there's somebody you're upsetting who's got more significance than any other being in the universe, you know?
Yeah. I'd never thought of that. I bought a book, I could have finished reading it, but it was about Magna Carta, and it was to do with the government taking all these laws away from us. But it comes down to really what God originally planned for man to be. And we can see we're so far from that now. And we're now seeing that the state is God, and some people want that.
Yes.
But it's not meaningful, and it's not what we were made to live for. We're made to live for God.
Yes.
And in relationship, indeed, in partnership with God, in partnership.
Absolutely.
Doing stuff. You know, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people's eyes are being opened about this to do with transhumanism.
Yes.
That question comes immediately to mind of what does it mean to be human if you can be augmented to the nth degree? Is there any humanity left? Well, who are we? And as you say, in the final analysis, we only mean anything if we are of value to someone who transcends this system.
Yeah.
There's nothing about transhumanism that's really transcendent. I think people are seeing that, and we'll see that a lot more in the future.
Yeah. What's really cool is that if you're in Christ, if you're in Yeshua, Jesus, you are no longer under this law. You might physically be, but you're not, your soul isn't. You're in the kingdom of God.
Yes.
It's so interesting that whenever you search into any of these legal things, there's a spiritual truth that comes out of them. Yeah.
Okay, well, before we forget it, we must talk a bit about your music, because that's gone through something of a transformation in recent times, hasn't it? From what I always think of course, Dissident Prophet, to something more disco-ish in style.
Yeah.
So what's that all about?
Because of the Divine Council thing, I now just want to worship, sing and party and dance in the presence of the Divine Council, in the presence of God, so that anyone can join in. And I don't want to preach the gospel. I just want to acknowledge God and have a good time and enjoy Him. So it's a different thing.
And why don't you want to preach the gospel through your music?
Well, I'll do that anyway, but not when I'm doing disco.
Why is that?
Because we're worshiping Him.
Okay. So you want to bring people into the worship experience?
Yeah.
Who may not realize initially that they are a mixture.
Uh-huh. People who are believers. It's mainly for people who are believers to be able to relax, chill out, and enjoy some music and enjoy and dancing with God and His angels and His presence this side of eternity right now in this world, in this state, in the Lord of the Rings, as it were. We want to do that.
Yeah.
But anyone can come in and enjoy that as well.
Oh, fantastic.
That's it.
That sounds brilliant. I wish you'd come and do this at Stan in the Park. That would be superb on a Sunday morning.
Well, maybe we can.
Yeah, maybe.
Because our music's good and we're getting good. We're getting good and we're playing some good stuff.
It always was good.
Well, this is a totally different discipline, really. I've had to learn to be funky and it's been great.
So it's not new wavy at all now, then?
There's little touches of, someone called it indie disco, so I suppose that's quite a good compliment.
It is.
It's not totally just funky, it is, but it's got these little nudges in it that slightly different things, try to mix up a bit so it's not just one flavor.
Well, I can tell you for sure that
the eastern sounding.
Oh, right. Listeners will want to hear it. So is there any chance we could use any of that for the intro and the outro on this show? What do you reckon?
Could do, yeah. I could send one track, because they're all in the mixing stage at the moment.
Well, if that's possible, that would be excellent, because I'm sure people would love to hear what the new sound is. And
I'd love people
to actually, hey, how about worshipping? Actually enjoy the worship experience for a few seconds, the beginning and the end. Why not?
The idea, Julian, and it wasn't for me. This was happening during lockdown, and I would drive back and forth from Birmingham to Knoll, where I was staying at the time. I was staying in someone's flat. And I don't normally, you know, whenever I hear someone say, God told me this, I usually think, no, He didn't. You know, it's my instant reaction. Is people who say, and then God said this, and then He said this, and then you know what God said? He said, Andy, you know, and
I had an experience of that at a Bible college that I went to for a year, and it was always the same people, and they always got up and they said, I've got a word from them. And I thought, oh no, here we go. And they would say the same thing. They'd say, my children, I love you. And I thought, oh no, that was some special word from God, was it? No, it wasn't. So I'm glad to hear you say that.
No, he didn't say anything. He just nudged me.
Okay.
I just sensed, like, go and do it. Because I was thinking, I want to do some disco music. And I just felt him nudge me in the car and went, go do it, have some fun.
Excellent.
So that was it, really.
Wonderful.
He said, make the phone calls.
You give me the impression that you feel very hopeful about the future. You have a vision for how things should be in your ministry, in the widest sense. Mm. What would you say to everybody listening? All right, bearing in mind, you know as well as I do, there are people who, most people listening are believers, there are people who are not believers, but, you know, they're interested to listen into conversations like this. But a lot of people who have been through similar experiences didn't know what to make of the church's response as things went along. Okay, so you have this positivity. It's been a very edifying conversation. It's great. What would your message be to the broadest audience? I know that's an impossible task. Speak to everybody, Andy. What would you say? What would your parting words be?
Okay, everyone out there.
I'll give you a moment to think. You've got a moment to think.
I'd just say, talk to God. I wouldn't worry about joining a church, joining an organisation, anything like that. Just be real and honest with God. Imagine you're going to die tomorrow. You're going to join a church or some big crusade or some big plan. We often want to do stuff, don't we, to kind of make ourselves feel like we're really, something's happening.
Yeah.
But I think you've got to actually believe. Jesus says, you believe in God, believe in me also. So
yeah.
What does that mean? It's trust. So how do you trust? Well, you've got to know someone's character. Mm. So I'd say go back and read the Gospels. Just read them again. Get to look at Jesus, what he's really like in context, and try and notice the subtle things. I think that's the most important thing, to know Jesus. Mm. That's it. I can't think whether you live or die, it's all that matters. So
yeah.
All the other things are just details. They'll follow, but
that's interesting. Yeah, they'll follow. That's an interesting point because, you know, people do say to me, and I take the point, it does worry me at times, is that, you know, we're supposed to be in fellowship. Hebrews says we're supposed to be in fellowship. That doesn't necessarily mean a particular church or particular institution. It does mean we must try to find people with whom we can enjoy God's presence, God's reality, of course.
Hmm.
So that's not peripheral. That's important.
Yeah.
But that can come out of the blue, can't it? That can come in ways that are completely unexpected.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I read a really good book recently called The Truth and Beauty. It was by Andrew Clavan from the Daily Wire. And it's about the romantic poets, about they'd just gone through the age of reason and seen that the French Revolution, that was what you got with just reason alone.
Right.
Guillotines.
Right.
Because they'd trashed the transcendent, which is what we call God, another word for God, something outside of us. And we thought science and reason was going to kind of save mankind. And we now know that it didn't.
Gosh, we're there again, aren't we?
We're there again with scientism. Mm. But something the romantic poets noticed was in nature, there was like a testimony of God. Mm. I think that's a really important thing. You know, it's just interesting. You can notice their yearning to understand really what truth is. In fact, do you know what? Here's a trick. Mm. And this is what my trick is. It's having a paradigm. You know, like when you buy a car and you suddenly see your car everywhere because your paradigm is that car now. You didn't see it before. And I think Jesus wants us to have a paradigm where we notice his truth and his beauty everywhere, not just in church or in the Bible, because his truth is universal. And once you start to see him, your life changes. You have a different view, even in the state of the time we're living. Instead of just focusing on all that stuff, because of course that exists, you can see evidence for God everywhere. You can even see evidence for God in people rejecting God. Mm. That's evidence that he exists. They're talking about him, right? But I mean, that's just a silly example. Yes. But you can see in nature.
Absolutely. No, it's not actually because Christian music is the thing. Right. I've had this conversation before. The kinds of music that I tend to listen to is not quote-unquote Christian music, because I find a lot of it very banal. Listening to really good, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, popular music, but really good stuff. You listen to some of those words and the music that's crafted around those words, and it can be very negative.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you see the humanity of that person. You hear the humanity of that person in their negativity, where they're coming from, and you can feel that sense of, yeah, but I know what the answer is to what you're experiencing, and that in itself can be an edifying experience.
Mm.
And I was just thinking of that recently because I went to Reading, where a lot of my relatives are. I stayed with my aunt and uncle, and they immediately, I couldn't believe they got an Alexa. And they said, Alexa, play some Christian music for us, or whatever it was they brought. And I went, oh, no. And they said, oh, you like Christian music, do you? And it was typically that sort of soft pop soul sound, and I have to admit that I'm not too keen on it. But when I explained what I've just talked about, they got what I meant. So yeah, I know what you mean. It wasn't a trivial thing to say at all. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Your band Distant Prophet, of course, has always been an antidote to that because it's Christian music and it's worth listening to. So there you go.
Oh, cool. Good stuff.
Absolutely.
I'll be honest with you, though, I never liked to do worship music or chorusy stuff or church stuff like that. And I never thought I'd do it, but I've changed. I'd actually want to sing praises to Jesus, which, you know, that I wasn't Distant Prophet, was it? It's more different to that. But
right, well, I'm not talking about the actual practice of praising. I'm talking about the quality of the music. There seems to be really really poor stuff out there that passes as quote-unquote Christian music.
And yes,
a lot of it's really not worth listening to.
Yeah,
but there are certain people who do seem to think, well, that's what you ought to be listening to.
Oh, I totally agree with you.
Nope.
I was thinking that to say it's kind of stuck in an era, isn't it? It used to be the pinky finger of the U2 style, and it's just stayed forever, that kind of music. A bit of Coldplay thrown in there, but you know, it's dreary. But Christian music is a substandard. Like, I'm not talking about worship music, but just Christian bands.
Yeah.
They're people that don't cut it secularly, because the secular world writes great music. Now, there's a few that pop through that are good, a few. But not many, let's be really honest. But I see God in really good music, you know, in good secular music.
Absolutely.
Because I'm not limiting God to, you know, Christian organisations.
You're right. You can indeed see God everywhere if you have eyes to see.
Oh, man.
You've used that phrase a lot yourself, haven't you? If you have eyes to see.
Yeah, just love songs. Most of the songs that were written under heaven are because of Cupid's arrow, aren't they? They're because of love, right? And that is proof of God, because, you know, why do we care? Why do we care when we're heartbroken? Why do we feel so in love? This is another thing that's my thing, desire, right? Look, I chatted with a guy the other day, and he came up to me. He's a guy who just went around the whole of the British Isles in a sailboat to raise money. Really interesting guy. And I happened to be in my aunt's house, and he was there. And he said, he just came in and he went, oh, well, you know, all that mankind has ever done has been parasitic and we're just a scourge on the earth. And I went, you sound like Noah Yuval Harari. And he went, well, oh, yeah, I've just read his book. You know, kind of thing. And, okay. You know, and he says, oh, yeah, and he's right. And I said, you really think that's true? You wake up every morning thinking that about life, that you are a scourge on the earth and everyone else is. Yeah. Is that really a way to look at life? And he's going, oh, I didn't say I was a believer in God. He says, oh, you sound like one of these people who believes in God or something, right? I says, forget that conversation. I says, let's think of desire. You loved going around the British Isles on your boat. You get up and you do that. Did you enjoy that? That's something you have pleasure doing. It fulfills a desire for you. But it's funny, isn't it, how desire isn't enough? We're never fulfilled in our desires. That's because we're made for God, because he can only fulfill our desires, because our desires are ultimately transcendent. So you notice in desire as being something that represent as a desire for God. So desire for love is brilliant. All these desires are good, that they're a shadow of the substance which is found in God.
Okay, and here's a really silly example, but it's something I've experienced. You know The Cure, Friday I'm in Love?
Yeah.
I love that song.
Yeah.
It can almost bring tears to my eyes because there's something about the humanity of that.
Yeah.
The teenage experience of, you know, being in love on Friday and being out of love on another day. But that's so human. That's so real.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you dwell on that, it does speak about something bigger than just this, what seems like a very trivial example. It's a universal experience of love that in itself is inadequate, but does speak of a bigger love. So even in a, it's a good song. As I say, it's a silly song. It's a good song, actually. I like it a lot because it has that impact on me. But even in a song as small as that, as it were, it speaks of something bigger.
Yeah.
And yet it's not Christian music.
Yeah. No, but look, some of the most X-rated literature is in the Bible, in the Song of Solomon. Mm? Yeah, it's very sexual, if you want to take it that way. Yeah. But God is a romantic. You read the book of Isaiah. Mm. He's a romantic. He's hurt. Mm. God has emotions. God has feelings.
Yeah.
Oh, he couldn't do that. He's God. One thing I've learned is he's a romantic. We're romantic. We're in the image of God.
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful, man. Once you start to see beauty everywhere, you can live in the worst of places and you'll see beauty even there. You'll see it in little subtle things. You don't have to travel the world, go to India. You can go to Tipton to find yourself, but you don't have to go far to discover truth and beauty.
That's right.
If you have the eyes, it's just a special thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. Loads and loads for us all to dwell on there. Fantastic, as I said before, an edifying conversation. You said to me, you hope that it would be of help to all of us, both of us and people listening. And I really think that is the case, because it's so hopeful. It's so positive. you know, we can dwell upon the negative things. And I think over the last 2 to 3 years, I have done too much on the podcast. I think that's inevitable because things were so dark for so long. Mm. And I'm trying now consciously, although people won't yet experience this. Humor has been one of the ways in which I've coped with it.
Yeah.
Over the last 2 to 3 years. I think it's important. Again, I think God's got a sense of humor. I know that's a cliche, but I think it's true. But yeah, I am consciously trying now to move back towards, this conversation is part of that, towards Christian things, positive things, coming out of that darkness, but hopefully still keeping a sense of what has happened and how we can learn from that.
Yeah.
But to try and find more balance within the podcast, seeing things more hopefully, more positively.
Well, I think it's worth knowing, there's a book called The State of Fear by Michael Crichton.
Oh, yes.
He wrote this in the 90s.
Right.
It's about climate change and the manipulation of all the things, you know, on both sides. But the point basically being made that we're kept in a state of fear, and that's how we're controlled.
Yeah.
Now, if you can realise that Jesus says, do not fear, you know, that makes a difference. You know that God wants us to not fear.
Yes.
So if we can work towards not fearing, I mean, it's not easy, but that's the intention, is to get to a state of no fear, not letting things take over.
Do you know, absolutely. Somebody who had a huge impact on me, a guy called Brian Austin, he said to me, when Jesus said, do not worry, take that as a command.
Right.
So often we think of it as, oh, don't worry. No, don't worry. It's good advice. No, take it as a command. Do not worry. Now, that as a command is a remarkable thing, because it makes you think about it differently. I'm actually supposed not to worry.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? It becomes an imperative then. It frees you not to worry. God wants me to rest in this experience of not worrying. Okay, that's a good thing.
Right.
Not to feel guilty about it. Oh, I should be worrying. No, stop worrying. Stop worrying.
Right.
No, hold on. I should be worrying. No. It's a command. Do not worry.
Mm.
I found that very freeing. And that's been really helpful, of course, over the last couple of years.
And one thing I'd recommend is a good thing to do for your diet for that. Switch off all the media, mainstream media, but also the other stuff.
Right.
Just really take discipline, attitude, switching things off, being offline, having time. Someone said the other day, if you want to get some music done, make sure you're not tuned into the Wi-Fi. Switch it off for 7.5 hours and then you'll get some good art made. Mm. But otherwise, you'll just be continually interrupted. Things we can do, simple things we can do to kind of make space, just like to get outdoors, not where you've got any stimulus, you're just walking outside, you're doing, or maybe doing some work that's physical.
Yeah.
There's some really good things you can do that are really Adamic in that sense, you know, as God made us to do. And to just break the system in very small ways, you don't have to do some big thing.
Yes.
Little things.
That's interesting you say to break the system. So actually, that could be actually subversive, can't it? Just to turn off the internet.
Yeah.
And give space to appreciating reality and actually practicing the presence of God as well.
Yeah.
If you've got that space,
you
can actually be aware of God's presence in a way that you can't if your device is going ping, ping, ping all the time. So going back to talking about doing simple, traditional things even,
well,
calling those subversive.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, when I lost my job, I had to get a job, you know. So I decided I'll just start my own business and be a gardener. A few people said, why don't you do it yourself? Why don't you just start your own business? I'm thinking, I can't do that. Never done that. It's like, yeah, you can. It's like, I'll have a go then.
Mm.
And then it's been all right. But
and
there's something happens in you when you do something you never thought you could do, and you kind of get more confidence and you get, and outdoors, and I'm loving that, being outdoors, getting the vitamin D and just, focusing on, when you focus on nature, I must say that I am blessed with nature, because you realise there's another world going on in nature that doesn't care what Klaus Schwab says, you know, like the dragonfly is doing his business, right, whether you like it or not, you know, and so, and that is a really important thing, because you think the world is just this world that we're all tuned into. And it's not. It's like Logan's Run, when they all escape and they end up find Peter Ustinov with a load of cats and he's eating grapes, you know, and it's all countryside. It's like, oh,
I've forgotten that detail. Yes,
you know, and it's like, oh, just getting out into the country, getting out of the city, getting out of the smart cities, getting into the stupid countryside.
Yes, which is where we're all going to end up in the end. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, it's been fantastic, Andy. Really, really excellent conversation.
Oh, cool.
Enjoyed it very much. Thanks ever so much for coming on, after all this time. And hopefully, as I'm speaking, we've got some of your music going on in the background. I do hope so. So I invite everybody to take a moment now to simply be in the presence of God and to worship him. Why not?
Hey,
exactly. It's been great speaking to you. Well, as it turned out, and as you can hear, we unfortunately didn't manage to get one of Andy's new tracks onto the end of the podcast before I needed to upload it. But what you can hear, no less worshipful, I think, is a track by Dissident Prophet called Out of the Cave, which Andy has kindly let me use for the intro and outro to this podcast. Thanks again to Andy for appearing on TMR once again. Great to speak with him, and I hope everyone enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Show notes can be found at The Mind Renewed, themindrenewed.com. Music copyright Dissident Prophet, all rights reserved, used with kind permission. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, and my guest, Andy Jennings, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.